find it out and tell them about it, they don't believe you. Tom gave him a dime and said we wouldn't tell nobody, and told him to buy some more thread to tie up his wool with, and then looks at Jim and says, I wonder if Uncle Silas is going to hang this nigger. If I was to catch a nigger that was ungrateful enough to run away, I wouldn't give him up, I'd hang him. And whilst the nigger stepped to the door to look at the dime and bit it to see if it was good, he whispers to Jim and says, Don't ever let on to know us, and if you hear any digging going on nights, it's us. We're going to set you free. Jim only had time to grab us by the hand and squeeze it. Then the nigger come back, and we said we'd come again sometime if the nigger wanted us to. And he said he would, more particular if it was dark, because the witches went for him mostly in the dark, and it was good to have folks around then. Chapter 35. It would be most an hour yet till breakfast, so we left and struck down into the woods, because Tom said we'd got to have some light to see how to dig by, and a lantern makes too much and might get us into trouble. What we must have was a lot of them rotten chunks that's called foxfire, and just makes a soft kind of glow when you lay them in a dark place. We fetched an armful and hid it in the weeds, and sat down to rest, and Tom says, kind of dissatisfied, Blame it, this whole thing is just as easy and awkward as it can be. And so it makes it so rotten difficult to get up a difficult plan. There ain't no watchman to be drugged. Now there ought to be a watchman. There ain't even a dog to give a sleeping mixture to. And there's Jim chained by one leg with a 10-foot chain to the leg of his bed. Why, all you gotta do is lift up the bedstead and slip off the chain. And Uncle Silas, he trusts everybody, sends the key to the pumpkin-headed nigger, and don't send nobody to watch the nigger. Jim could have got out of that window hole before this, only there wouldn't be no use trying to travel with a 10-foot chain on his leg. Why, drat it, Huck. It's the stupidest arrangement I ever see. You got to invent all the difficulties. Well, we can't help it. We got to do the best we can with the materials we've got. Anyhow, there's one thing. There's more honor in getting him out through a lot of difficulties and dangers, where there weren't one of them furnished to you by the people who it was their duty to furnish them, and you had to contrive them all out of your own head. Now look at just that one thing of the lantern. When you come down to the cold facts, we simply got to let on that a lantern's risky. Why, we could work with a torchlight procession if we wanted to, I believe. Now, whilst I think of it, we got to hunt up something to make a saw out of, the first chance we get. What do we want of a saw? What do we want of it? Ain't we got to saw the leg of Jim's bed off so as to get the chain loose? Why, you just said a body could lift up the bedstead and slip the chain off. Well, if that ain't just like you, Huck Finn. You can get up the infant schooliest ways of going at a thing. Why, ain't you ever read any books at all? Baron Trenck, nor Casanova, nor Benvenuto Cellini? Nor Henry IV, nor none of them heroes? Who ever heard of getting a prisoner loose in such an old maidy way as that? No, the way all the best authorities does is to saw the bed leg in two and leave it just so, and swallow the sawdust so it can't be found, and put some dirt and grease around the sawed place so the very keenest seneschal can't see no sign of its being sawed, and thinks the bed leg is perfectly sound. Then, the night you're ready, fetch the leg a kick, down she goes. Slip off your chain, and there you are. Nothing to do but hitch your rope ladder to the battlements, shin down it, break your leg in the moat, because a rope ladder is 19 foot too short, you know. And there's your horses and your trusty vassals, and they scoop you up and fling you across the saddle and away you go, to your native Languedoc or Navarre, or wherever it is. It's gaudy, Huck. I wish there was a moat to this cabin. If we get time, the night of the escape, we'll dig one. I says, What do we want of a moat when we're going to snake him out from under the cabin? But he never heard me. He had forgot me and everything else. He had his chin in his hand, thinking. Pretty soon he sighs and shakes his head, and then sighs again and says, No, it wouldn't do. There ain't necessity enough for it. For what? I says. Why, to saw Jim's leg off, he says. Good land, I says. Why, there ain't no necessity for it. And what would you want to saw his leg off for anyway? Well, some of the best authorities has done it. They couldn't get the chain off, so they just cut their hand off and shoved. And a leg would be better still, but we got to let that go. There ain't necessity enough in this case. And besides, Jim's a nigger and wouldn't understand the reasons for it, and how it's the custom in Europe, so we'll let it go. But there's one thing. He can have a rope ladder. We can tear up our sheets and make him a rope ladder easy enough. And we can send it to him in a pie. It's mostly done that way. And I've et worse pies. "Why, Tom Sawyer, how you talk," I says. "Jim ain't got no use for a rope ladder." "He has got use for it. How you talk, you better say. You don't know nothing about it. He's got to have a rope ladder. They all do." "What in the nation can he do with it?" "Do with it? He can hide it in his bed, can he? That's what they all do, and he's got to, too. Huck, you don't ever seem to want to do anything that's regular. You want to be starting something fresh all the time. Suppose he don't do nothing with it. Ain't it there in his bed for a clue after he's gone? And don't you reckon they'll want clues? Of course they will. And you wouldn't leave them any? That would be a pretty howdy-do, wouldn't it? I never heard of such a thing." "Well," I says, "if it's in the regulations and he's got to have it, all right, let him have it. Because I don't wish to go back on no regulations. But there's one thing, Tom Sawyer. If we go to tearing up our sheets to make Jim a rope ladder, we're going to get into trouble with Aunt Sally just as sure as you're born. Now, the way I look at it, a hickory bark ladder don't cost nothing, and don't waste nothing, and is just as good to load up a pie with, and hide in straw tick, as any rag ladder you can start. And as for Jim, he ain't had no experience, and so he don't care what kind of a..." "Oh, shucks, Huck Finn. If I was as ignorant as you, I'd keep still. That's what I'd do. Who ever heard of a state prisoner escaping by a hickory bark ladder? Why, it's perfectly ridiculous." "Well, all right, Tom, fix it your own way. But if you'll take my advice, you'll let me borrow a sheet off of the clothesline." He said that would do, and that gave him another idea. And he says, "Borrow a shirt, too." "What do we want of a shirt, Tom?" "Want it for Jim to keep a journal on." "Journal your granny. Jim can't write." "S'pose he can't write. He can make marks on the shirt, can he? If we make him a pen out of an old pewter spoon or a piece of an old iron barrel hoop." "Why, Tom, we can pull a feather out of a goose and make him a better one, and quicker, too." "Prisoners don't have geese running around the dungeon keep to pull pens out of, you muggins. They always make their pens out of the hardest, toughest, troublesomest piece of old brass candlestick or something like that they can get their hands on. And it takes them weeks and weeks and months to file it out, too, because they've got to do it by rubbing it on the wall. They wouldn't use a goose quill if they had it. It ain't regular." "Well, then, what'll we make him the ink out of?" "Many makes it out of iron rust and tears, but that's the common sort in women. The best authorities use their own blood. Jim can do that, and when he wants to send any little common ordinary mysterious message to let the world know where he's captivated, he can write it out on the bottom of a tin plate with a fork and throw it out of the window. The Iron Mask always done that, and it's a blame good way, too. Jim ain't got no tin plates. They feed him in a pan. That ain't anything. We can get him some. Can't nobody read his plates. That ain't got nothing to do with it, Huck Finn. All he's got to do is write on the plate and throw it out. You don't have to be able to read it. Why, half the time you can't read anything a prisoner writes on a tin plate or anywhere else." "Well, then, what's the sense in wasting the plates?" "Why, blame it all. It ain't the prisoner's plates. But it's somebody's plates, ain't it? Well, supposing it is, what does the prisoner care who's..." He broke off there, because we heard the breakfast horn blowing, so we cleared out for the house. Along during that morning, I borrowed a sheet and a white shirt off the clothesline, and I found an old sack and put them in it, and we went down and got the foxfire and put that in, too. I called it borrowing, because that was what Pap always called it, but Tom said it weren't borrowing, it was stealing. He said we was representing prisoners, and prisoners don't care how they get a thing, so they get it, and nobody don't blame them for it, either. It ain't no crime in a prisoner to steal a thing he needs to get away with, Tom said. It's his right, and so, as long as we was representing a prisoner, we had a perfect right to steal anything on this place we had the least use for, to get ourselves out of prison with. He said if we weren't prisoners, it would be a very different thing, and nobody but a mean, ornery person would steal when he weren't a prisoner. So we allowed we would steal everything there was that come handy. and yet he made a mighty fuss one day after that when I stole a watermelon out of the nigger patch and eat it, and he made me go and give the niggers a dime without telling them what it was for. Tom said that what he meant was we could steal anything we needed. Well, I says I needed the watermelon, but he said I didn't need it to get out of prison with. There's where the difference was. He said if I'd have wanted to hide a knife in it and smuggle it to Jim to kill the Seneschal with, it would have been all right. So I let it go at that, though I couldn't see no advantage in my representing a prisoner if I got to sit down and chaw over a lot of gold-leaf distinctions like that every time I see a chance to hog a watermelon. Well, as I was saying, we waited that morning till everybody was settled down to business and nobody in sight around the yard. Then Tom, he carried the sack into the lean-to, whilst I stood off a piece to keep watch. By and by he come out, and we went and sat down on the woodpile to talk. He says, "Everything's all right now, except tools, and that's easy fixed." "Tools?" I says. "Yes." "Well, tools for what?" "Why, to dig with." "We ain't a-going to gnaw him out, are we? Ain't them old crippled picks and things in there good enough to dig a nigger out with?" I says. He turns on me, looking pitying enough to make a body cry, and says, "Huck Finn, did you ever hear of a prisoner having picks and shovels and all the modern conveniences in his wardrobe to dig himself out with? Now, I want to ask you, if you've got any reasonableness in you at all, what kind of a show would that give him to be a hero? Why, they might as well lend him the key and done with it. Picks and shovels, while they wouldn't furnish him to a king." "Well, then," I says, "if we don't want the picks and shovels, what do we want?" "A couple of case knives." "To dig the foundations out from under that cabin with?"
"Yes."
"Confound it, it's foolish, Tom."
"It makes no difference how foolish it is. It's the right way, and it's the regular way. And there ain't no other way that I ever heard of, and I've read all the books that gives any information about these things. They always dig out with a case knife, and not through dirt, mind you. Generally, it's through solid rock. And it takes them weeks and weeks and weeks, and forever and ever. Why, look at one of them prisoners in the bottom dungeon of the Castle Deef, in the harbor of Marseille that dug himself out that way. How long was he at it, you reckon?"
"I don't know."
"Well, guess."
"I don't know. A month and a half?"
37 years. And he come out in China. That's the kind. I wish the bottom of this fortress was solid rock."
"Jim don't know anybody in China."
"What's that got to do with it? Neither did the other fellow. But you're always a-wandering off on a side issue. Why can't you stick to the main point?" "All right. I don't care where he comes out, so he comes out. And Jim don't either, I reckon. But there's one thing, anyway. Jim's too old to be dug out with a case knife. He won't last."
"Yes, he will last, too. You don't reckon it's going to take 37 years to dig out through a dirt foundation, do you?"
"How long will it take, Tom?"
"Well, we can't risk being as long as we ought to, because it mayn't take very long for Uncle Silas to hear from down there by New Orleans. He'll hear Jim ain't from there. Then his next move will be to advertise Jim or something like that. So we can't risk being as long digging him out as we ought to. By rights, I reckon we ought to be a couple of years, but we can't. Things being so uncertain, what I recommend is this. That we really dig right in as quick as we can. And after that, we can let on to ourselves that we was at it 37 years. Then we can snatch him out and rush him away the first time there's an alarm. Yes, I reckon that'll be the best way."
"Now there's sense in that," I says. "Letting on don't cost nothing. Letting on ain't no trouble, and if it's any object, I don't mind letting on we was at it 150 years. It wouldn't strain me none after I got my hand in. So I'll mosey along now and smouch a couple of case knives."
"Smouch 3, he says. "We want one to make a saw out of."
"Tom, if it ain't unregular and irreligious to suggest it," I says. "There's an old rusty saw blade around yonder sticking under the weatherboard and behind the smokehouse." He looked kind of weary and discouraged like and says, "It ain't no use to try to learn you nothing, Huck. Run along and smouch the knives, 3 of them." So I done it.
Chapter 36.
As soon as we reckoned everybody was asleep that night, we went down the lightning rod and shut ourselves up in the lean-to, and got out our pile of foxfire and went to work. We cleared everything out of the way about 4 or 5 foot along the middle of the bottom log. Tom said he was right behind Jim's bed now, and we'd dig in under it. And when we got through, there couldn't nobody in the cabin ever know there was any hole there, because Jim's counterpin hung down most of the ground, and you'd have to raise it up and look under to see the hole. So we dug and dug with the case knives till most midnight, and then we was dog-tired and our hands was blistered, and yet you couldn't see we'd done anything, hardly. At last I says, "This ain't no 37-year job. This is a 38-year job, Tom Sawyer." He never said nothing, but he sighed, and pretty soon he stopped digging, and then for a good little while I knowed he was thinking. Then he says, "It ain't no use, Huck. It ain't a-going to work. If we was prisoners, it would, because then we'd have as many years as we wanted in no hurry, and we wouldn't get but a few minutes to dig every day while they was changing watches, and so our hands wouldn't get blistered, and we could keep it up right along, year in and year out, and do it right and the way it ought to be done. But we can't fool along. We got to rush. We ain't got no time to spare. If we was to put in another knot this way, we'd have to knock off for a week to let our hands get well. Couldn't touch a case knife with them sooner." "Well, then what we going to do, Tom?" "I'll tell you, it ain't right, and it ain't moral, and I wouldn't like it to get out, but there ain't only just the one way. We got to dig 'em out with the picks, and let on it's case knives." "Now you're talking," I says. "Your head gets leveler and leveler all the time, Tom Sawyer," I says. "Picks is the thing, moral or no moral, and as for me, I don't care shucks for the morality of it nohow. When I start in to steal a nigger, or a watermelon, or a Sunday school book, I ain't no ways particular how it's done, so it's done. What I want is my nigger, or what I want is my watermelon, or what I want is my Sunday school book. And if a pick's the handiest thing, that's the thing I'm a-going to dig that nigger, or that watermelon, or that Sunday school book out with. And I don't give a dead rat what the authorities thinks about it, nuther." "Well," he says, "there's excuse for picks and letting on in a case like this. If it weren't so, I wouldn't approve of it, nor I wouldn't stand by and see the rules broke. Because right is right, and wrong is wrong. And a body ain't got no business doing wrong when he ain't ignorant and knows better. It might answer for you to dig Jim out with the pick, without any letting on, because you don't know no better. But it wouldn't for me, because I do know better. Give me a case knife." He had his own by him, but I handed him mine. He flung it down and says, "Give me a case knife." I didn't know just what to do, but then I thought. I scratched around amongst the old tools and got a pickaxe and give it to him. And he took it and went to work and never said a word. He was always just that particular, full of principle. So then I got a shovel, and then we picked and shoveled, turned about, and made the fur fly. We stuck to it about a half an hour, which was as long as we could stand up, but we had a good deal of a hole to show for it. When I got up the stairs, I looked out the window and see Tom doing his level best with the lightning rod. But he couldn't come it, his hands was so sore. At last he says, "It ain't no use. It can't be done. What do you reckon I better do? Can't you think up no way?" "Yes," I says, "but I reckon it ain't regular. Come up the stairs and let on it's a lightning rod." So he'd done it. Next day Tom stole a pewter spoon and a brass candlestick in the house for to make some pens for Jim out of, and 6 tallow candles. And I hung around the nigger cabins laid for a chance and stole 3 tin plates. Tom said it wasn't enough, but I said nobody wouldn't ever see the plates that Jim throwed out, because they'd fall in the dog fennel and jimson weeds under the window hole. Then we could tote them back and he could use them over again. So Tom was satisfied. Then he says, "Now, the thing to study out is how to get the things to Jim." "Take them in through the hole," I says, "when we get it done." He only just looked scornful and said something about nobody ever heard of such an idiotic idea, and then he went to studying. By and by, he said he had ciphered out 2 or 3 ways, but there weren't no need to decide on any of them yet. Said we'd got to post Jim first. That night we went down the lightning rod a little after 10 and took one of the candles along, and listened under the window hole and heard Jim snoring. So we pitched it in and it didn't wake him. Then we whirled in with the pick and shovel, and in about 2 hours and a half the job was done. We crept in under Jim's bed and into the cabin and pawed around and found the candle and lit it and stood over Jim a while and found him looking hearty and healthy, and then we woke him up gentle and gradual. He was so glad to see us he almost cried and called us honey and all the pet names he could think of, and was for having us hunt up a cold chisel to cut the chain off his leg with right away and clearing out without losing any time. But Tom, he showed him how unregular it would be and sat down and told him all about our plans and how we could alter them in a minute any time there was an alarm and not to be the least afraid because we would see he got away, sure. So Jim, he said it was all right, and we sat there and talked over old times a while. And then Tom asked him a lot of questions. And when Jim told him Uncle Silas come in every day or two to pray with him, and Aunt Sally come in to see if he was comfortable and had plenty to eat, and both of them was kind as they could be, Tom says, "Now I know how to fix it. We'll send you some things by them." I said, "Don't do nothing of the kind. It's one of the most jackass ideas I ever struck." But he never paid no attention to me, went right on. It was his way when he'd got his plan set. So he told Jim how we'd have to smuggle in the rope ladder pie and other large things by Nat, the nigger that fed him, and he must be on the lookout and not be surprised, and not let Nat see him open them, and we would put small things in Uncle's coat pockets, and he must steal them out, and we would tie things to Aunt's apron strings or put them in her apron pocket if we got a chance, and told him what they would be and what they was for, and told him how to keep a journal on the shirt with his blood and all that. He told him everything. Jim, he couldn't see no sense in the most of it, but he allowed we was white folks and knowed better than him, so he was satisfied, and said he would do it all just as Tom said. Jim had plenty corncob pipes and tobacco, so we had a right down good sociable time. Then we crawled out through the hole and so home to bed, with hands that looked like they'd been chawed. Tom was in high spirits. He said it was the best fun he ever had in his life, and the most intellectual, and said if he could only see his way to it, we would keep it up all the rest of our lives and leave Jim to our children to get out. For he believed Jim would come to like it better and better the more he got used to it. He said that in that way, it could be strung out to as much as 8 a year and would be the best time on record. And he said it would make us all celebrated that had a hand in it. In the morning, we went out to the woodpile and chopped up the brass candlestick into handy sizes, and Tom put them and the pewter spoon in his pocket. Then we went to the nigger cabins, and while I got Nat's notice off, Tom shoved a piece of candlestick into the middle of a corn pone that was in Jim's pan, and we went along with Nat to see how it would work. And it just worked noble. When Jim bit into it, it most mashed all his teeth out, and there weren't ever anything could have worked better. Tom said so himself. Jim, he never let on, but what it was only just a piece of rock or something like that that's always getting into bread, you know. But after that, he never bit into nothing, but what he jabbed his fork into it 3 or 4 places first. And whilst we was standing there in the dimmish light, here comes a couple of the hounds bulging in from under Jim's bed. And they kept on piling in till there was 11 of them, and there weren't hardly room in there to get your breath. By jings, we forgot to fasten that lean-to door. The nigger Nat, he only just hollered, "Witches!" once, and keeled over onto the floor amongst the dogs, and begun to groan like he was dying. Tom jerked the door open and flung out a slab of Jim's meat, and the dogs went for it, and in 2 seconds he was out himself and back again and shut the door, and I knowed he'd fixed the other door, too. Then he went to work on the nigger, coaxing him and petting him, and asking him if he'd been imagining he saw something again. He raised up and blinked his eyes around and says, "Mars Sid, you'll say I's a fool, but if I didn't believe I saw most 1 million dogs or devils or summon, I wished I may die right here in these tracks. I did most surely. Mars Sid, I felt 'em. I felt 'em, sir. They was all over me. Dad fetched, I just wished I could get my hands on one of them witches just once, only just once. It's all I'd asked. But mostly, I wish they'd let me alone, I does." Tom says, "Well, I'll tell you what I think. What makes them come here just at this runaway nigger's breakfast time? It's because they're hungry, that's the reason. You make them a witch pie, that's the thing for you to do.
But my land, Ma Sid, how's I gwine to make them a witch pie? I don't know how to make it. I ain't ever heard of such a thing before.
Well, then, I'll have to make it myself.
Will you do it, honey, will you?
I'll wash up the ground under your foot, I will. All right, I'll do it, seeing it's you, and you've been good to us and showed us the runaway nigger. But you got to be mighty careful. When we come around, you turn your back, and then whatever we've put in the pan, don't you let on to see it at all. And don't you look, and when Jim unloads the pan, something might happen, I don't know what. And above all, don't you handle the witch things.
Handle 'em, Ma Sid? What is you talking about? I wouldn't lay the weight of my finger on 'em. Not for 10,000,000,000,000 dollars, I wouldn't.
Chapter 37. That was all fixed. So then we went away and went to the rubbish pile in the backyard, where they keep the old boots and rags and pieces of bottles and wore-out tin things and all such truck, and scratched around and found an old tin washpan, and stopped up the holes as well as we could, to bake the pie in, and took it down cellar and stole it full of flour, and started for breakfast, and found a couple of shingle nails that Tom said would be handy for a prisoner to scrabble his name and sorrows on the dungeon walls with, and dropped one of them in Aunt Sally's apron pocket, which was hanging on a chair, and t'other we stuck in the band of Uncle Silas's hat, which was on the bureau, because we heard the children say their pa and ma was going to the runaway nigger's house this morning. And then we went to breakfast, and Tom dropped the pewter spoon in Uncle Silas's coat pocket, and Aunt Sally wasn't come yet, so we had to wait a little while. And when she come, she was hot and red and cross and couldn't hardly wait for the blessing. And then she went to sluicing out coffee with one hand and cracking the handiest child's head with her thimble with the other, and says,
"I've hunted high, and I've hunted low, and it does beat all. What has become of your other shirt?"
My heart fell down amongst my lungs and livers and things, and a hard piece of corn crust started down my throat after it and got met on the road with a cough, and was shot across the table and took one of the children in the eye and curled him up like a fishing worm and let a cry out of him the size of a war whoop. And Tom, he turned kinder blue around the gills, and it all amounted to a considerable state of things for about a quarter of a minute or as much as that, and I would have sold out for half price if there was a bidder. But after that we was all right again. It was the sudden surprise of it that knocked us so kind of cold. Uncle Silas, he says,
"It's most uncommon curious. I can't understand it. I know perfectly well I took it off because..."
"Because you ain't got but one on. Just listen at the man. I know you took it off, and I know it by a better way than your wool-gathering memory, too, because it was on the clothesline yesterday. I see it there myself. But it's gone. That's the long and short of it, and you'll just have to change to a red flannel one till I can get time to make a new one. And it'll be the third I've made in 2 years, and it just keeps a body on the jump to keep you in shirts. And whatever you manage to do with them all is more'n I can make out. A body'd think you would learn to take some sort of care of them at your time of life."
"I know it, Sally, and I do try all I can. But it oughtn't to be altogether my fault, because you know I don't see them nor have nothing to do with them except when they're on me, and I don't believe I've ever lost one of them off of me."
"Well, it ain't your fault if you haven't, Silas. You'd have done it if you could, I reckon. And the shirt ain't all that's gone, nuther. There's a spoon gone, and that ain't all. There was 10, and now there's only 9. The calf got the shirt, I reckon, but the calf never took the spoon, that's certain."
"Why, what else is gone, Sally?"
"There's 6 candles gone, that's what. The rats could have got the candles, and I reckon they did. I wonder they don't walk off with the whole place, the way you're always going to stop their holes and don't do it. And if they weren't fools, they'd sleep in your hair, Silas. You'd never find it out. But you can't lay the spoon on the rats, and that I know."
"Well, Sally, I'm in fault, and I acknowledge it. I've been remiss, but I won't let tomorrow go by without stopping up them holes."
"Oh, I wouldn't hurry. Next year'll do. Matilda Angelina Araminta Phelps!"
Whack comes the thimble, and the child snatches her claws out of the sugar bowl without fooling around any. Just then the nigger woman steps onto the passage and says,
"Missus, there's a sheep gone."
"A sheep gone? Well, for land's sake."
"I'll stop up them holes today," says Uncle Silas, looking sorrowful.
"Oh, do shut up.
S'pose the rats took the sheet?
Where's it gone, Lize?"
"Claw to goodness, I ain't no notion, Miss Sally. She was on the clothesline yesterday, but she done gone. She ain't there no more now."
"I reckon the world is coming to an end. I never see the beat of it in all my born days. A shirt and a sheet and a spoon and 6 can,
Missus," comes a young yaller wench.
"Dey's a brass candlestick missing. Clear out from here, you hussy, or I'll take a skillet to you."
Well, she was just a bilin'. I begun to lay for a chance. I reckoned I would sneak out and go for the woods till the weather moderated. She kept a raging right along, running her insurrection all by herself, and everybody else mighty meek and quiet. And at last Uncle Silas, looking kind of foolish, fishes up that spoon out of his pocket. She stopped, with her mouth open and her hands up. And as for me, I wished I was in Jerusalem or somewheres. But not long, because she says,
"It's just as I expected. So you had it in your pocket all the time? And like as not, you've got the other things there, too. How'd it get there?"
"I really don't know, Sally," he says, kind of apologizing. "Or, you know, I would tell. I was a-studying over my text in Acts 17 before breakfast, and I reckon I put it in there, not noticing, meaning to put my testament in. And it must be so, because my testament ain't in, but I'll go and see. And if the testament is where I had it, I'll know I didn't put it in. And that will show that I laid the testament down and took up the spoon and..."
"Oh, for land's sake! Give a body a rest. Go along now, the whole kit and biling of you. And don't come nigh me again till I've got back my peace of mind."
I'd have heard her if she'd said it to herself, let alone speaking it out. And I'd have got up and obeyed her if I'd have been dead. As we was passing through the setting room, the old man, he took up his hat, and the shingle nail fell out on the floor, and he just merely picked it up and laid it on the mantel shelf, and never said nothing, and we went out. Tom see him do it, and remembered about the spoon, and says,
"Well, it ain't no use to send things by him no more. He ain't reliable."
Then he says, "But he done us a good turn with the spoon anyway, without knowing it, and so we'll go and do him one without him knowing it. Stop up his rat holes." There was a noble good lot of them down cellar, and it took us a whole hour, but we done the job tight and good, and ship shape. Then we heard steps on the stairs, and blowed out our light and hid. And here comes the old man with a candle in one hand and a bundle of stuff in t'other, looking as absent-minded as year before last. He went a-mooning around, first to one rat hole and then another, till he'd been to them all. Then he stood about 5 minutes, picking tallow drip off of his candle and thinking. Then he turns off slow and dreamy towards the stairs, saying,
"Well, for the life of me, I can't remember when I done it.
I could show her now that I weren't to blame on account of the rats. But never mind, let it go. I reckon it wouldn't do no good." And so he went on a mumbling upstairs, and then we left. He was a mighty nice old man, and always is. Tom was a good deal bothered about what to do for a spoon, but he said we'd got to have it, so he took a think. When he had ciphered it out, he told me how we was to do. And then we went and waited around the spoon basket till we see Aunt Sally coming, and then Tom went to counting the spoons and laying them out to one side, and I slid one of them up my sleeve, and Tom says,
"Why, Aunt Sally, there ain't but 9 spoons yet."
She says,
"Go long to your play, and don't bother me. I know better. I counted them myself."
"Well, I've counted them twice, Auntie, and I can't make but 9. She looked out of all patience, but of course she come to count. Anybody would.
"I declare to gracious, there ain't but 9, she says. "Why, what in the world? Plague take the things. I'll count 'em again."
So I slipped back the one I had, and when she got done counting, she says,
"Hang the troublesome rubbish, there's 10 now."
And she looked huffy and bothered both, but Tom says,
Why, Auntie, I don't think there's 10.
You numbskull, didn't you see me count 'em?
I know, but, well, I'll count 'em again.
So I smouched one, and they come out 9, same as the other time. Well, she was in a tearing way, just a trembling all over, she was so mad. But she counted and counted, till she got that addled, she'd started to count in the basket for a spoon sometimes. And so 3 times they come out right, and 3 times they come out wrong. Then she grabbed up the basket and slammed it across the house, and knocked the cat galley west. And she said clear out and let her have some peace, and if we come bother around her again betwixt that and dinner, she'd skin us. So we had the odd spoon, and dropped it in her apron pocket while she was giving us our sailing orders. And Jim got it all right, along with her shingle nail, before noon. We was very well satisfied with this business, and Tom allowed it was worth twice the trouble it took, because he said now she couldn't ever count them spoons twice alike again to save her life, and wouldn't believe she'd counted them right if she did, and said that after she'd about counted her head off for the next 3 days, he judged she'd give it up and offer to kill anybody that wanted her to ever count them any more. So we put the sheet back on the line that night and stole one out of her closet, and kept on putting it back and stealing it again for a couple of days, till she didn't know how many sheets she had any more, and said she didn't care, and weren't a-going to bullyrag the rest of her soul out about it, and wouldn't count them again not to save her life. She'd rather die first. So we was all right now, as to the shirt and the sheet and the spoon and the candles, by the help of the calf and the rats and the mixed-up counting. And as to the candlestick, it weren't no consequence. It would blow over by and by. But that pie was a job. We had no end of trouble with that pie. We fixed it up away down in the woods and cooked it there, and we got it done at last and very satisfactory, too, but not all in 1 day, and we had to use up 3 washpans full of flour before we got through, and we got burnt pretty much all over in places and eyes put out with the smoke, because, you see, we didn't want nothing but a crust, and we couldn't prop it upright, and she would always cave in. But of course we thought of the right way at last, which was to cook the latter 2 in the pie. So then we laid in with Jim the 2nd night, and tore up the sheets all in little strings, and twisted them together, and long before daylight we had a lovely rope that you could have hung a person with. We let on it took 9 months to make it. And in the forenoon we took it down to the woods, but it wouldn't go in the pie. Being made of a whole sheet that way, there was rope enough for 40 pies, if we'd have wanted them, and plenty left over for soup or sausage or anything you choose. We could have had a whole dinner. But we didn't need it. All we needed was just enough for the pie, and so we throwed the rest away. We didn't cook none of the pies in the washpan, afraid the solder would melt. But Uncle Silas, he had a noble brass warming pan, which he thought considerable of, because it belonged to one of his ancestors, with a long wooden handle that come over from England, with William the Conqueror and the Mayflower, or one of them early ships, and was hid away up garret with a lot of other old pots and things that was valuable. Not on account of being any account, because they weren't, but on account of them being relics, you know, and we snaked her out private and took her down there. But she failed on the 1st pies, because we didn't know how. But she come up smiling on the last one. We took and lined her with dough, and set her in the coals, and loaded her up with rag rope, and put on a dough roof, and shut down the lid, and put hot embers on top, and stood off 5 foot with the long handle, cool and comfortable, and in 15 minutes she turned out a pie that was a satisfaction to look at. But the person that ate it would want to fetch a couple of kegs of toothpicks along. For if that rope ladder wouldn't cramp him down to business, I don't know nothing what I'm talking about. And lay him in enough stomach ache to last him till next time, too. Nat didn't look when we put the witch pie in Jim's pan, and we put the 3 tin plates in the bottom of the pan under the victuals, and so Jim got everything all right, and as soon as he was by himself, he busted into the pie and hid the rope ladder inside of his straw tick, and scratched some marks on a 10 plate and throwed it out of the window hole. Chapter 38. Making them pens was a distressed tough job, and so was the saw, and Jim allowed the inscription was going to be the toughest of all. That's the one which the prisoner has to scrabble on the wall. But we had to have it. Tom said we'd got to. There weren't no case of a state prisoner not scrabbling his inscription to leave behind, and his coat of arms. "Look at Lady Jane Grey," he says.
Look at Guilford Dudley. Look at old Northumberland. Why, Huck, suppose it is considerable trouble. What you going to do? How you going to get around it? Jim's got to do his inscription and coat of arms. They all do. Jim says,
Why, Mars Tom, I ain't got no coat of arms. I ain't got nothing but dish your old shirt. And you knows I got to keep the journal on that.
Oh, you don't understand, Jim. A coat of arms is very different. Well, I says, Jim's right, anyway, when he says he ain't got no coat of arms, because he ain't. I reckon I knowed that, Tom says. But you bet he'll have one before he goes out of this, because he's going out right, and there ain't going to be no flaws in his record. So whilst me and Jim filed away at the pens on a brickbat apiece, Jim a-making his'n out of the brass, and I making mine out of the spoon, Tom set to work to think out the coat of arms. By and by, he said he'd struck so many good ones, he didn't hardly know which to take. But there was one which he reckoned he'd decide on. He says, On the scutcheon we'll have a bend, or in the dexter base, a saltire Murray in the fess, with a dog, couchin' for common charge, and under his foot a chain embattled for slavery, with a chevron vert and a chief engrailed, and three invected lines on a field azure, with the nombril points rampant on a dancette indented. Crest, a runaway nigger, sable with his bundle over his shoulder on a bar sinister, and a couple of gules for supporters, which is you and me. Motto, Majore Freta Minore Auto. Got it out of a book. Means the more haste, the less speed. Gee willikins, I says. But what does the rest of it mean? We ain't got no time to bother over that, he says. We got to dig in like all get out. Well, anyway, I says, what's some of it? What's a fess? A fess? A fess is... You don't need to know what a fess is. I'll show him how to make it when he gets to it. Shucks, Tom, I says, I think you might tell a person. What's a bar sinister? Oh, I don't know. But he's got to have it, all the nobility does. That was just his way. If it didn't suit him to explain a thing to you, he wouldn't do it. You might pump at him a week, it wouldn't make no difference. He'd got all the coat of arms business fixed, so now he started to finish up the rest of that part of the work, which was to plan out a mournful inscription. Said Jim got to have one like they all done. He made up a lot and wrote them out on a paper and read them off so. 1. Here a captive heart busted. 2. Here a poor prisoner, forsook by the world and friends, fretted out his sorrowful life. 3. Here a lonely heart broke, and a worn spirit went to its rest after 37 years of solitary captivity. 4. Here, homeless and friendless, after 37 years of bitter captivity, perished a noble stranger, natural son of Louis XIV. Tom's voice trembled whilst he was reading them, and he most broke down. When he got done, he couldn't no way make up his mind which one for Jim to scrabble onto the wall. They was all so good. But at last, he allowed he would let him scrabble them all on. Jim said it would take him a year to scrabble such a lot of truck onto the logs with a nail, and he didn't know how to make letters besides. But Tom said he would block them out for him, and then he wouldn't have nothing to do but just follow the lines. Then pretty soon he says, Come to think, the logs ain't a-going to do. They don't have log walls in a dungeon. We got to dig the inscriptions into a rock. We'll fetch a rock. Jim said the rock was worse than the logs. He said it would take him such a pisin' long time to dig them into a rock, he would never get out. But Tom said he would let me help him do it. Then he took a look to see how me and Jim was getting along with the pens. It was most pesky, tedious, hard work and slow, and didn't give my hands no show to get well of the sores. And we didn't seem to make no headway, hardly. So Tom says, I know how to fix it. We got to have a rock for the coat of arms and mournful inscriptions, and we can kill two birds with that same rock. There's a gaudy big grindstone down at the mill, and we'll smouch it and carve the things on it and file out the pens and the saw on it, too. It weren't no slouch of an idea, and it weren't no slouch of a grindstone, nuther, but we allowed we'd tackle it. It weren't quite midnight yet, so we cleared out for the mill, leaving Jim at work.
We smouched the grindstone and set out to roll her home, but it was a most nation-tough job. Sometimes, do what we couldn't keep her from falling over, and she come mighty near mashing us every time. Tom said she was going to get one of us sure before we got through. We got her halfway, and then we was plumb played out and most drowned with sweat. We see it weren't no use. We got to go and fetch Jim. So he raised up his bed and slid the chain off of the bed leg and wrapped it round and round his neck, and we crawled out through our hole and down there, and Jim and me laid into that grindstone and walked her along like nothing, and Tom superintended. He could out-superintend any boy I ever see. He knowed how to do everything. Our hole was pretty big, but it weren't big enough to get the grindstone through. But Jim, he took the pick and soon made it big enough. Then Tom marked out them things on it with the nail and set Jim to work on them, with a nail for a chisel and an iron bolt from the rubbish in the lean-to for a hammer, and told him to work till the rest of his candle quit on him, and then he could go to bed, and hide the grindstone under his straw tick and sleep on it. Then we helped him fix his chain back on the bed leg and was ready for bed ourselves. But Tom thought of something and says,
"You got any spiders in here, Jim?"
"No, sir. Thanks to goodness I hain't, Mars Tom."
"All right, we'll get you some."
"But bless you, honey, I don't want none. I's afeared of 'em, and I'd just as soon have rattlesnakes around."
Tom thought a minute or two and says,
"It's a good idea, and I reckon it's been done. It must have been done, it stands to reason." "Yes, it's a prime good idea. Where could you keep it?"
"Keep what, Mars Tom?"
"Why, a rattlesnake."
"De goodness gracious alive, Mars Tom. Why, if dey was a rattlesnake to come in here, I'd take and bust right out through that log wall, I would, with my head."
"Why, Jim, you wouldn't be afraid of it after a little. You could tame it."
"Tame it?"
"Yes, easy enough. Every animal is grateful for kindness and petting, and they wouldn't think of hurting a person that pets them. Any book will tell you that. You try, that's all I ask. Just try for 2 or 3 days. Why, you can get him so in a little while that he'll love you and sleep with you and won't stay away from you a minute and will let you wrap him around your neck and put his head in your mouth."
"Please, Mars Tom, don't talk so. I can't stand it. He'd let me shove his head in my mouth for a favor, hain't he? I'd lay he'd wait a powerful long time before I asked him. And more than that, I don't want him to sleep with me."
"Jim, don't act so foolish. A prisoner's got to have some kind of a dumb pet, and if a rattlesnake ain't ever been tried, why, there's more glory to be gained in you being the first to ever try it than any other way you could ever think of to save your life."
"Why, Mars Tom, I don't want no sich glory. Snake taken by Jim's chin off. Den where's the glory? No, sir, I don't want no sich doings."
"Blame it. Can't you try? I only want you to try. You needn't keep it up if it don't work."
"But the trouble all done if the snake bites me while I's a-trying him. Mars Tom, I's willing to tackle most anything that ain't unreasonable. But if you and Huck fetches a rattlesnake in here for me to tame, I's gwine to leave. That's sure."
"Well, then, let it go, if you're so bullheaded about it. We can get you some garter snakes, and you can tie some buttons on their tails and let on their rattlesnakes, and I reckon that'll have to do."
"I can stand them, Mars Tom, but blame if I couldn't get along without 'em. I tell you that. I never knowed before 'twas so much bother and trouble to be a prisoner."
"Well, it always is when it's done right. You got any rats around here?"
"No, sir. I ain't seed none."
"Well, we'll get you some rats."
"Why, Mars Tom, I don't want no rats. They's the dead blamedest creatures to stir a body and rustle round over him and bite his feet when he's trying to sleep I ever see. No, sir. Give me garter snakes if I's got to have 'em, but don't give me no rats. I ain't got no use for 'em, scarcely."
"But, Jim, you got to have 'em. They all do. So don't make no more fuss about it. Prisoners ain't ever without rats. There ain't no instance of it. And they train them and pet them and learn them tricks, and they get to be as sociable as flies. But you got to play music to them. You got anything to play music on?"
I ain't got nothing but a coast comb and a piece of paper and a juice harp. But I reckon they wouldn't take no stock in a juice harp.
Yes, they would. They don't care what kind of music 'tis. A juice harp's plenty good enough for a rat. All animals likes music. In a prison, they dote on it. Especially painful music. And you can't get no other kind out of a juice harp. It always interests them. They come out to see what's the matter with you. Yes, you're all right. You're fixed very well. You want to sit on your bed nights before you go to sleep, and early in the mornings, and play your juice harp. Play The Last Link Is Broken. That's the thing that'll scoop a rat quicker than anything else. And when you've played about 2 minutes, you'll see all the rats and the snakes and spiders and things begin to feel worried about you and come. And they'll just fairly swarm over you and have a noble good time.
Yes, they will, I reckon, Mars Tom. But what kind of time is Jim having? Blessed if I can see the pine. But I'll do it if I got to. I reckon I better keep the animals satisfied and not have no trouble in the house.
Tom waited to think over and see if there wasn't nothing else. And pretty soon he says, Oh, there's one thing I forgot. Could you raise a flower here, do you reckon?
I don't know, but maybe I could, Mars Tom. But it's tolerable dark in here, and I ain't got no use for no flower nohow, and she'd be a powerful sight of trouble.
Well, you try it anyway. Some other prisoners has done it.
One of them big cattail-looking mullein stalks would grow in here, Mars Tom, I reckon. But she wouldn't be worth half the trouble she'd cause.
Don't you believe it. We'll fetch you a little one, and you plant it in the corner over there and raise it. And don't call it mullein. Call it Picciola. That's its right name when it's in prison. And you want to water it with your tears.
Why, I got plenty spring water, Mars Tom.
You don't want spring water. You want to water it with your tears. It's the way they always do.
Why, Mars Tom, I lay I can raise one of them mullein stalks twice with the spring water, whilst another man's a-starting one with tears.
That ain't the idea. You got to do it with tears.
She'll die on my hands, Mars Tom. She surely will. 'Cause I don't scarcely ever cry.
So Tom was stumped. But he studied it over, and then said Jim would have to worry along the best he could with an onion. He promised he would go to the nigger cabins and drop one, private, in Jim's coffee pot in the morning. Jim said he would just soon have tobacco in his coffee, and found so much fault with it and with the work and bother of raising the mullein and juice harping the rats and petting and flattering up the snakes and spiders and things, on top of all the other work he had to do on pens and inscriptions and journals and things, which made it more trouble and worry and responsibility to be a prisoner than anything he ever undertook, that Tom most lost all patience with him, and said he was just loading down with more gaudier chances than a prisoner ever had in the world to make a name for himself, and yet he didn't know enough to appreciate them, and they was just about wasted on him. So Jim, he was sorry, and said he wouldn't behave so no more, and then me and Tom shoved for bed.
Chapter 39 In the morning, we went up to the village and bought a wire rat trap and fetched it down, and unstopped the best rat hole, and in about an hour we had 15 of the bulliest kind of ones. And then we took it and put it in a safe place under Aunt Sally's bed. But while she was gone for spiders, little Thomas Franklin Benjamin Jefferson Alexander Phelps found it there and opened the door of it to see if the rats would come out, and they did. And Aunt Sally, she come in, and when we got back, she was a-standing on top of the bed raising Cain, and the rats was doing what they could to keep off the dull times for her. So she took and dusted us both with the hickory, and we was as much as 2 hours catching another 15 or 16. Drat that meddlesome cub, and they weren't the likeliest nother, because the first haul was the pick of the flock. I never see a likelier lot of rats than what that first haul was. We got a splendid stock of sordid spiders and bugs and frogs and caterpillars and one thing or another. And we'd like to got a hornet's nest, but we didn't. The family was at home. We didn't give it right up, but stayed with them as long as we could, because we allowed we'd tire them out, or they'd got to tire us out, and they done it. Then we got Allie Cumpane and rubbed on the places, and was pretty near all right again, but couldn't set down convenient. And so we went for the snakes and grabbed a couple of dozen garters and house snakes and put them in a bag and put it in our room, and by that time it was supper time, and a rattling good honest day's work. And hungry? Oh, no, I reckon not. And there weren't a blessed snake up there when we went back. We didn't half tie the sack, and they worked out somehow and left. But it didn't matter much, because they was still on the premises somewheres. So we judged we could get some of them again. No, they weren't no real scarcity of snakes about the house for a considerable spell. You'd see them dripping from the rafters in places every now and then, and they generally landed in your plate or down the back of your neck, and most of the time where you didn't want them. Well, they was handsome and striped, and there